Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest this week grew up in West Newton, Massachusetts, and during junior high school, and college, he was a vendor at Fenway Park in Boston. From 2008 to 2019, he was the sixth president of the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum. And in 2019, he and photographer Gene Fruth co-founded Grassroots Baseball, whose mission is to promote and celebrate the amateur game around the globe with a focus on growing interest and participation at the youngest levels. His name, Jeff Idelson. And I'm Jack Pasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Pasula. This is Anything Is Possible. And we're talking to Jeff Idelson, who from 2008 to 2019 was the sixth president of the National Baseball Hall of Fame and Museum. Jeff, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Pleasure's all mine, Jack. Great to be with you.
Can you talk to us about growing up in West Newton, Massachusetts, and also about your mom and your dad, please?
Absolutely. I was fortunate to grow up in a loving household with parents who not only were wonderful parents, but appreciated and loved baseball. And so I went to my first game at Fenway Park when I was 5 years old. I remember going with my parents and my grandparents and sitting in the right field grandstands. And like every kid my age, seeing that expanse of green, not only the grass, but at Fenway, you had the left field wall, the green monster, things like that. But I had a really good childhood, Jack. I loved playing Little League growing up. I loved being outside with my friends. And like any other kid growing up in the 70s, baseball was meant everything to me.
What position did you play, Jeff, and how good were you?
How bad was I? Well, I was bad enough to be kicked out after I turned 12. But no, I love Little League. And, I had a couple of years where I actually played all nine positions when I was with the Cubs. Actually, I did that one game. But I was pretty much a center fielder because I had speed and I could run a little bit.
All right. During junior high school and college, you were a vendor at Fenway Park. First off, can you share with us one or two of your signature calls as a vendor?
Oh, boy, Jack, I haven't thought of that in a long time. But I guess, I sold a lot of different things during my tenure there. But like peanuts, hey, get your peanuts. Who wants peanuts? Peanuts, peanuts. Who wants peanuts? And then, of course, we also sold souvenirs like the little mini bats and stuff like that. So you'd get hats, bats, balls, and dolls. Who wants a mini bat? Hats, bats, balls, and dolls, mini bats. That's a couple.
During those years, any interaction with the players?
As a matter of fact, there was, Jack. I mean, I was at Fenway because I loved the game. And my best friend, Larry Pike, who I grew up with, a nuisance third grade, he got me the job as a vendor. So we would go in together. But one of my great memories was we had a closer named Bill Campbell, who had been with the Twins. And Bill came over to the Red Sox, I want to say in 80 or 81. And I was out in the bleachers selling ice cream one day, and it was before the game. And I was down by the bullpen, and Bill Campbell sees me, and he says, "Hey, kid, do you have any ice cream?" I said, "Of course I have ice cream." He said, "Can I have one?" I said, "Do you have any money? They're 80 cents. He said, "I don't have any money. I'm in the bullpen." I said, "Well, what do you have?" He said, "How about if I give you a couple baseballs?" And that started a little bit of a tradition, not often, of my trading ice cream for baseballs from Bill Campbell.
Today, Jeff, you'd be suspended for a week, I think.
It's a different time, Jack. It was a little more congenial back then.
All right, 1986, you become an intern with the Red Sox Public Relations Office, and then 87 and 88, you actually got paid doing that job. You saw Roger Clemens, you saw Wade Boggs, Jim Rice, Dwight Evans, Billy Buckner. Talk about those years with the Red Sox.
It was a lot of fun, Jack. I mean, I remember I was graduating from Connecticut College in New London, Connecticut, and I had a degree in economics, and senior year, the career placement office says to me, "Well, what are you going to do with your life? Are you going to go to graduate school or what are you going to do?" And I said, "Well, I don't want to go back to school." And they said, "Well, what do you like?" I said, "I like baseball." They said, "Well, try to work in baseball." And, back then it never occurred to me, and there weren't that many positions, but I got lucky enough to be an intern in 86, as you mentioned. And that was a great year with everything that went on. And that was a fun clubhouse. It was a lot of fun. And, the great trade we made in July at the deadline, sending Steve Lyons to the White Sox, brought us Tom Seaver. And so as I moved on to Cooperstown, 86 to 89 years later, I had been with Seaver, I had been with Jim Rice, and I had been with Wade Boggs, and had a relationship with them, and that sort of set my course for the future.
Roger Clemens was on that team those years. How good was he?
He was incredible. I mean, he was just at that time throwing straight gas, and there were some games that he just was striking out 14, 15, 16 guys at a pop. And I was actually at his debut as a vendor. I remember going and saying, I remember debuts. It's a strange thing, Jack, but when you love the sport, you remember these things. And I'm like, man, I get Roger Clemens. I wonder if this kid will be any good. And, you know, 86, he turned it up a notch. I started just after his first 20 strikeout game, which came against the Seattle Mariners, I believe, on April 29th. And then, wouldn't you know, 10 years later, here I am in Cooperstown and know Roger well. Then he comes to your native city, Detroit, strikes out 20 Tigers. And I said to him, I said to the club, you know, could we get something from Roger for the Hall of Fame? And his respect and reverence for the game and its history, Jack, was profound. And the PR guy said he's already back. He's already boxed up his hat, his glove, and Bill Hasselman's met the kid who caught him, the guy who caught him, and it's already on its way to Cooperstown. That's the essence of Roger Clemens, is his profound respect for the history of the game.
All right. For your family and friends in 1989, you go to the dark side. You go work for those Yankees. Did half your family disown you?
It's more like three quarters, Jack. I mean, it's an intense relationship up there. I don't think, you know, maybe the Mets and the Cardinals are similar, but I grew up with Bucky Dent as the protagonist in my life, the antagonist in my life. I mean, he hit the big home run that put Boston out of the playoffs in 78. And here I go to, you know, not only do I then go to New York, but I end up having Bucky as a manager. But as I went, people were like, what are you doing? And I had vowed I wanted to get in baseball full time. The Red Sox had nothing, and I would go to any of the other 22 teams other than the Yankees. And sure enough, the Yankees come calling. What I soon realized, Jack, is that my love was for the game, not for the Red Sox. And that started to override everything at that point.
We're talking to Jeff Adelson, who worked for the Yankees from 89 to 93. When we come back, we're going to ask him first about the boss, George Steinbrenner. And I'm Jack Masulla, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Brasula. We're with Jeff Adelson, and from 1989 to 1994, he worked for the New York Yankees, Director of Media Relations and Publicity. Tell us about first the boss.
Well, you know, the what I had that was an added value was I wasn't from New York, Jack. So the people that work from New York that were from New York in blood pinstripes, they would take the brunt of it from the boss because they weren't going anywhere. Their love for the Yankees overrode everything. But for me, I was just a guy coming in from the outside. So I get hired in 89. I'm 24 years old. I go to the opening. There was a party that was thrown by the Equitable Company as a send off to spring training. And I just said, you know what? I'm going to go up to him and say hello. And when the position was open, Jack, there were two of us that were left at the end that were going to be the finalists for the position. It was Bob Miller, who you probably remember from Detroit, who had been, he was Dan Ewald's assistant for many years. And then I was in Boston. And so Bob ended up taking the job with the Orioles, which was also open. And I had interviewed in Baltimore, and I ended up with the Yankees. So I go and I meet Mr. Steinbrenner, and I walk up to him in a brazen way. And I say, Mr. Steinbrenner, I just wanted to introduce myself. I'm Jeff Adelson, and I can't tell you how delighted I am to be here working for the Yankees. And he looks at me, he grabs both of my shoulders and shakes me. He says, young man, I'm glad to have you aboard. You're the young man from Detroit, right? I said, no, sir, I'm the young man from Boston. And he said, I have three words of advice for you, son. I said, what's that? He said, rent, don't buy.
He was famous for firing managers. I think he fired Billy Martins three times. Did he ever fire you?
Oh, he fired me a couple times. And then there was one incident where he fired me over something that leaked in the paper, which I didn't even know how to leak anything in the paper at that age. I mean, it's just the only leaks were in the ceiling of my house. And, you know, he called me the next morning when I didn't show up. He said, where are you? You're supposed to be at work. I said, you fired me. He said, don't listen to that. Get your ass down here. Pardon my language. But the next thing I knew, I was down there.
All right. During those 5 years with the Yankees, Goose Gossage had a short stint. Dave Winfield, Ricky Henderson, Don Mattingly was kind of the star those years. Talk about some of those players.
It was a great clubhouse, and Don Mattingly leading the way as the team captain and one of the greatest guys. And It was a time of transition for the Yankees. They were really starting to flip things, but you had Ricky Henderson and Dave Winfield, who both went on to Cooperstown. Again, guys I worked with, and Ricky wasn't there that long. We traded him in June for to Oakland for three players, and that was definitely a year of change. We had the 5 years I was there. We had five managers, six pitching coaches. I don't know how many GMs, maybe four GMs. It was constant turmoil, but for me, it was just great being around this club and being around the genesis of what the Yankees are. And when Gene Michael came in at the end as the last GM I worked with, it was he who really started to build and shape that team for what it became after I left, which was a dynasty.
All right. From 86 to 94, you worked with two of the most iconic teams in baseball history, the Red Sox and the Yankees, in Boston and in New York City. Then on September 26th, 1994, you go to this little sleepy town called Cooperstown. You get hired Baseball Hall of Fame Director of Public Relations. Culture shock going from New York City to Cooperstown. Tell us first about Cooperstown.
Well, no doubt, Jack. I mean, you want to talk about a culture shock. It certainly was that, but I was ready for it, and I loved what the Hall of Fame stood for and the opportunity to have to be able to work with the staff there. And Cooperstown is just this gorgeous little village. You know it well, Jack. You love the Hall of Fame. And boy, it's a town of 1,800 with one stoplight. It sits at the base of this beautiful 9-mile-long lake, Otsego Lake. And it's nestled between the Catskills and the Adirondacks. And quite honestly, when you're driving in along the lake road, and if you were to close your eyes and then open them again, you would think everything was in black and white, because it's truly a time standing still kind of place. You know, the Hall of Fame is, with all of its splendor, is in the middle of Main Street, right in the middle of town, which is great. But this definitely felt like a step back in time. It also felt like I was driving into a Norman Rockwell painting. It had that kind of Americana feel.
One time I took artist Doug West there, I don't know, in a January morning. We stayed at the Otsego, and we walked to the hall about 2-3 blocks, and it was 23 below zero with about 3 feet of snow. How cold does it get in the winter in Cooperstown?
You want to know how cold it gets, Jack? I'll tell you, because I'm an avid runner, okay? And I run outside all year long. And when you run outside and you come back and your eyelids are frozen stuck because it's so cold, that's how it gets in Cooperstown.
Our hairs in the nose rose in our little walks. It's cold. All right. Tell us about this Otsego Hotel.
Yeah, the Otisauga Hotel on Lake Otsego is a grand hotel. It's beautiful, beautiful, big grand hotel. It used to be a girls' finishing school in the late 19th century and got converted into a hotel in 1909. And it is where all the Hall of Famers stay during Hall of Fame weekend. It's about 150 rooms. It's got a huge back veranda overlooking the lake, this great golf course called Leatherstocking was designed by Deverett Emereux, who's one of the great golf course designers of the early 20th century. And, you know, it's certainly a majestic place and a great symbol for the style of Cooperstown.
One of the greatest experiences of my life was one Saturday morning, you and James Forbes Clark let me golf with George Brett, Yogi Berra, and a Chicago guy named Bill Murray. Being together with Bill Murray and Yogi for 4.5 hours, unbelievable, unbelievable. tell us about the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Well, the Baseball Hall of Fame was built in 1936-7-8 and opened in 1939. So we're 82 years old now, and it's a tribute to the game's greatest players, contributors, and those that have touched the game. It's three institutions under one roof, Jack. It's a museum. It is a library. It's a museum and a library. It's an education facility, and it's a Hall of Fame. And under the umbrella of the Hall of Fame, kids are educated in schools every day about using baseball as a lens to teach everyday school day topics. The museum recounts the glorious history of our game dating back to the mid-1800s, and the Hall of Fame is, of course, the sanctuary where the game's greats are honored.
The stuff you have in there is unbelievable. Can you share with us three or four of the most spectacular items you have in that Hall of Fame?
Well, you know, for everybody who comes through who's a baseball fan, that's gonna feel different, you know, based on where you grew up in the country, you know, and who you rooted for. But for me, some of the real seminal pieces are, number one, the Doubleday baseball, which dates back to 1839, when it was believed that Abner Doubleday had invented the game, and it's the reason that we're in Cooperstown. I'd have to say the glove Willie Mays used for the catch in 1954 in the World Series off of Vic Wirtz, when the Giants won the World Series, is a pretty poignant piece. We have a bat that Babe Ruth used in 1927 when he hit 60 home runs. He out-homered every National League team and all but three American League teams. And what's unique about this bat, Jack, is that back then you could sort of deface your equipment, not alter it, but deface it. And when he was hitting home runs, he'd get back to the bench and he had a little penknife on the bench, and he would make a little carve around the trademark where the Louisville Slugger oval is when he hit a home run. This bat has 28 carvings in it, which means he had 28 of his 60 home runs with the bat. So those three things, and maybe the uniform that Elston Howard wore, one of the earliest artifacts I got, feels especially important given that he integrated the Yankees just after Jackie Robinson integrated the Dodgers.
And I believe in 1964, he was the American League MVP. And a unique thing, the American League, National League, MVP, the MVP of the NFL and AFL, all wore number 32.
Did not know that.
Okay. And I'm Jack Krizula, and we're with Jeff Idelson. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Krizula with Jeff Idelson, who from 2008 to 2019 was the president of the Baseball Hall of Fame. He's now the interim president again. So welcome back.
Thank you, Jack.
334 players since 1869 have gotten into the Baseball Hall of Fame. It's the toughest one to get into, and there's only 72 living. Talk to us about when 60 or so of these living Hall of Famers come back for the induction weekend every year.
You know, for us, it is the greatest reunion on the baseball calendar every year, Jack, to have all of these living legends that span multiple decades and generations in one place at one time. There's nothing like it. And if you've been to Cooperstown, you can imagine this tiny little town, as I mentioned, with one stoplight in this open field. And here you have all these legends just there in front of you. For the fans, it's like your baseball cards coming to life because you get to be up close and personal with them. This year, obviously, is going to be a different situation. There won't be a public induction because of COVID. It'll be televised and shown on the MLB network. But as you come back next year and in years past, what it is an opportunity to see your heroes up close and personal.
It's on Sunday is the actual induction ceremonies. And then on Sunday night, there's a dinner where the Hall of Famers welcome the new Hall of Famers. And there's only two non-Hall of Famers that get to go in there. One is the chairman, Jane Forbes Clark, and the other is the president of the Baseball Hall of Fame. So you were in those dinners. What can you share, if anything, about those dinners?
Well, you know, it's really a chance. It's like those guys getting back in the clubhouse is what it is. I mean, they go through these events all weekend long, and then all of a sudden it's like they're back being players again. And so you got a table with the home run hitters. You got the middle infielders at another table. You have the pitchers at another table. And this is not by design. This is how they gravitate. And, you know, for me, I would usually sit with some of the older guys and the commissioner, Rob Manfred. He would be in there. Really, it's just a chance for these guys to have fun. The new guys who get in, Jack, that's when they get their Hall of Fame ring, and that's when it really becomes official. They've given their speech, and they get the ring, and now, as far as the Hall of Famers are concerned, they're now welcome to the club.
All right. On April 16, 2008, you became the actual president of the Baseball Hall of Fame. You had a 25-year run in Cooperstown. What's, Jeff Idelson, what's the single biggest thing you learned from all those legendary Hall of Famers over those 25 years?
What I really learned, Jack, is that I'm often asked about what the egos are like. What are these guys like? How big are the egos? But what I think I've learned is that there is when you get to that level of ability, and that level of success in any industry, there especially in baseball, there tends to be a fine line between confidence and arrogance. And I think the guys that are have gotten to that level and done so successfully, they speak more on the confidence side. The arrogance tends to be with those who aren't quite there. And so what I learned is that these guys are human. They're approachable. They're amenable. And on top of it all, they're the greatest that ever played the game.
All right. Sadly, since April 6th of 2020, for the last 13 months, we've lost 10 iconic Hall of Famers. L. Kaline, Tom Seaver, Lou Brock, Bob Gibson, Whitey Ford, Joe Morgan, Phil Niekro, Hank Aaron, Tommy Lasorda, Don Sutton. Could you tell us about Mr. Tiger, L. Kaline?
Well, you know better than this, Jack. I mean, being a Detroit guy and JR audience, that there was no greater gentleman than Al Kaline. Baltimore guy, and it's, you know, you think of him and Brooks Robinson are both great gentlemen, and maybe it's because one played in Baltimore and one's from Baltimore. But Al was just, in addition to being just an incredible right fielder, of course, Mr. Tiger, 3,000 hits, all the accolades. He was a guy that was very, very proud of what he accomplished, and also also proud of the Tigers and spending his entire career there. He was a quiet guy coming back to Cooperstown. The one note about him is he always liked to stay in the same room, which is on the right side of the hotel and overlooked a little bit of the lake and the boats.
He and Louise would come every year. So, all right, you gave the eulogy for Ed Whitey Ford. Tell us about Whitey Ford.
Well, you know, Whitey Ford was a tough one for me because I, you know, knew him from my Yankee days as well. And so I had a long relationship with him and his wife. And he was the chairman of the board. One of my favorite stories about Whitey, to just a little bit funny, is that we were putting together a ballot once of players who may have been overlooked from 1950 and earlier. And I'm in this room with Whitey, and I'm Monty Irvin, Ralph Kiner, Bob Feller, Al might have been in there. And we're discussing these candidates, Jack. And there's a guy named Spud Chandler who pitched for the Yankees for 10 years in the 1930s and had, I believe, a 715 winning percentage. And Whitey Ford has the fourth highest winning percentage in history. Now he was third until Clayton Kershaw surpassed him. And I said to Whitey very jokingly, how can you explain that Spud Chandler is on the outside looking in, and he's obviously a markedly better pitcher than you ever were, and here you are sitting in Cooperstown? And he looks me right in the eye without missing a beat, and he says, Jeff, he didn't have to go out drinking with Mickey and Billy every night like I did. But Whitey, all kidding aside, Jack, I loved Whitey. I mean, he was a great pitcher. He was a great ambassador for the game and grew up playing stickball in New York. He was the quintessential New Yorker.
And his wife, his widow wife, Joan, was as nice as they could, right? As nice as they come. Okay, I think as the years have gone by with those Sunday night dinners, I think it was Tom Seaver started bringing some very fancy wine, and then these other pitchers wanted to outdo him. Tell us about Tom and Nancy Seaver.
One of my closest friends. It seems like I say that about a lot of them, but Tom, of course, I knew all the way back to '86. He and Jim Rice and Wade Boggs, and Tom loved the game. I mean, he was on the board of the Hall of Fame for many, many years. He was on the board of Little League for years. He cared about the grassroots game. And, you know, for a kid who grew up in Fresno, he came a long way. And he was as successful as you can be as a pitcher. We all know that. But then he became a successful winemaker. And he had this vision. He bought a piece of land in Calistoga, Northern California, not far from where I live now. And, you know, the realtor said to him, you can never grow grapes on this. But he saw what the realtor didn't. He cleared it and set up a Cabernet grape farm. And he was into it. He was out there pruning every day, Jack. He and Nancy both. And they had the wine makers right there on the campus. And he equated winemaking to me to baseball. He said, it's a lot like a baseball season. You plant your crop in April. You take care of it during the summer. And with any luck, you go to the World Series and you have a banner crop in the fall. And he kind of equated the seasons and the similarities to baseball. And, you know, he ended up on the cover of Wine Spectator magazine as having one of the great wines in 2016. And you're right. Those wines were all over Cooperstown, Hall of Fame weekend.
That year in 1969 when they overtook my Cubs. All right. That was all right. Speaking of my Cubs, they made a few mistakes through the years. One, we had a left fielder by the name of Lou Brock, and we traded him for a nobody, all right? And we lost Lou Brock and his wife, Jackie. Tell us about Lou Brock.
Well, Lou was one of the smartest guys I knew. I mean, he just was he had a brain like none other. And he cared about baseball in St. Louis. He cared about kids. He always would ask me about my family. Loved coming to Cooperstown. And I just was sad when he passed. He had been ill for a while. He had lost part of his leg 5 or 6 years later because of diabetes, and a tragic end for a great base stealer and a tremendous human being.
Extremely classy as well, huh? Very classy.
Very classy.
All right. Huh. Not just one of the iconic all-time baseball players, but iconic Americans of all time. Hammerin' Hank Aaron, please.
That was tough. I mean, Hank represented everything about baseball: opportunity, brilliance, excellence, desegregation. Not long after Jackie Robinson, he integrated the Southern League. This guy was a mountain of a man. And, as he often said, I didn't want people to forget Babe Ruth. He said, I just didn't want them to forget me either. And the legacy he left as a player is indelible. What he overcame and had to deal with, breaking Babe Ruth's mark for home runs in 1973 and 74, was just horrific, that nobody should ever have to deal with. The amount of hate mail this guy got, death threats, stuff like you've never believed. And he persevered in the face of great adversity. And, you know, when he was done, he became a businessman. He became successful, but he developed his foundation, Chasing the Dream, that's all about taking care of kids and kids with music. And that's where his heart was for the last 30 years. And I'm just grateful that this world got to know Hank Aaron, because he left an indelible footprint.
One more, Tommy Lasorda. Kirk Gibson, I had him on a few months ago, played for him, of course, 88. He said, we never had meetings with Tommy. We had eatings with Tommy. Loved to eat. Got a story about Lasorda?
Yeah, in fact, the story with Lasorda is about how much of a motivator he was. And of course, it came with eating, because we were at his favorite Chinese restaurant, Paul's Kitchen in Los Angeles. And so it's just him and me. This is like about 5 years ago. And it's just the two of us. And if it were you and me, Jack, going to lunch, we'd probably each get one of the lunch specials and be happy. Well, this Tommy gets like 7 or 8 different dishes. I mean, the table is just covered with food. And it's just insane. And when you talk about leadership, as you know, Jack, leadership comes in different forms. And with Tommy, it was motivation. And he told me this great story about his talking to his granddaughter. And his granddaughter was an equestrian person. You know, she liked riding horses and jumping. And she came up to Tommy one day and she said, Grandpa, I need a new horse. And Tommy said, well, what's wrong with your horse? And she said, it just isn't jumping high enough. And he looks at her and he says, let me talk to the horse.
He was the Mr. Ed before there was Mr. Ed. We're with Jeff Idelson, and I'm Jack Vasula. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Jack Vasula, host of WJR's Anything Is Possible, the weekly radio visit, brings his 15 years of inspirational storytelling to hardcover. With God, anything is possible. Anything is possible. 15 of Jack's more than 750 tales of defeating odds and achieving the extraordinary. Like Bob Woodruff, whose job covering the war in Iraq nearly cost him his life. And Nick Vujicic, the limbless evangelist who has stunned millions with his message of acceptance and grace. With God, anything is possible. Order now while signed copies are still available at trustinusllc.square.site. That's trustinusllc.square.site. And as Jack says,
make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom.
Anything is possible.
I'm Jack Vasula. This is Anything Is Possible. We're talking to Jeff Idelson. And since 2019, he and photographer Gene Fruth are the co-founders of Grassroots Baseball. If you want to learn more, www.grassrootsbaseball.org. First, tell us about Gene Fruth.
Well, Gene Fruth is one of the great preeminent photographers of all time. She has a heart of gold when it comes to kids. She shoots the major league game, but her passion is with kids. And during her tenure with the Hall of Fame, I got to witness that firsthand, where she'd be shooting an event, and I'd say, well, where are you going now? And she'd say, I'm peeling off and going to a Little League game. And that was the essence of, and is the essence of Jean. So she approached me about when I was getting ready and contemplating retirement from the Hall of Fame, and asked me if I'd have any interest in developing this book, Grassroots Baseball, Where Legends Begin, which was her first book and book about the grassroots game around the globe. She asked what I thought about turning it into a program, and the idea of promoting the amateur game and giving back in underprivileged communities to help grow the game. And it took me all of about 2 seconds to say yes. And after the 2019 induction came to a conclusion, that's when we really started in earnest on the development of that program.
That program is a road trip across America and about Route 66 and the romance of Route 66. For the young listeners tonight, what is Route 66?
Route 66 was the first federal highway connecting the Midwest to the West. It was built it opened in 1926. It took a while to build, but it basically goes from Chicago to Santa Monica and winds through eight states. Kansas is the one that's short shrift the most. It only travels through Kansas for all of 13 miles. But when we were launching the program, I asked Jean, well, we have to launch somewhere. What do you want to do? She said, how about Route 66? Because you talk about two great bastions of Americana. You have the Mother Road and you have baseball. And what we've learned over a couple of years of documenting the game and staging clinics in different cities along Route 66 is just how well baseball is thriving in these small communities, and how well and how strong volunteerism is, and the commitment from coaches, and how much baseball means to kids. And it's been rewarding for Gene and me personally to see this. And I think to be able to document these cities and these kids and give them a platform is only going to continue to elevate the game and help us all.
Talk about volunteerism. A number of the living Hall of Famers, Jim Thome, et cetera, have gone out of their way, giving you yeoman support and help. Can you talk about what some of the Hall of Famers have done with grassroots baseball?
Absolutely, Jack. So we're able to get nice sponsorship from the Diamondbacks and the Padres that allowed us to work with the Cal Ripken Senior Foundation to purchase Rawlings gloves and baseballs and to stage clinics with kids all across the country. And we did a ton of clinics along Route 66 over the last couple of years. And for guys, there's nothing, the equipment is one thing, the inspiration is another thing. And who better to deliver inspirational messages than Hall of Famers who grew up in those areas and other retired major league stars. So whether it was Jim Thome in Chicago, he grew up in Peoria, Johnny Bench in Oklahoma, Ozzie Smith in St. Louis, Goose Gossage did three clinics for us. There's nobody who speaks to grassroots baseball better than Goose. George Brett, your golfing buddy from 2005 on the West Coast, Billy Hatcher in Arizona. They came in and imparted their words of wisdom, Trevor Hoffman, and their words of encouragement and letting kids know that following their passion is what's important, and giving them an introduction to the game, meaningful in so many communities. And we're happy to have made an impact, and also know that a number of those kids we reached ended up playing summer baseball and starting to take it up.
Tell us about the people you've met in these small towns throughout America, Jeff.
Oh, we've met some great, great people along the way. We were just in, Gene and I were just in Baxter Springs, Kansas, which is this tiny little town in the southeast corner of Kansas, Jack, that's right between Oklahoma, Commerce, Oklahoma, where Mickey Mantle grew up, and Joplin, Missouri. And that whole region speaks of Mantle because, he grew up in Commerce. He was signed in Baxter Springs by Tom Greenwade, great scout from the Yankees, and he played his little league in Joplin. So you feel like you're transported back in time. But in Baxter Springs is a guy named Wayne Metcalf there, who's 84. He is the district administrator. He's the league president, or he was the league president for 37 years. He's still the groundskeeper, still takes care of this pristine little league field that he built with the help of the community. And we were there for opening day of Little League, and you would think it was the World Series. The entire town was there. The kids marched out on the field. And that's just like a great example of a community coming together and supporting what they love.
If you want to learn more, www.grassroots.baseball.org. Tell us about these Little League presidents, the managers, the coaches, the umpires, the concession stand workers who donate their time and talents for these kids.
It's refreshing to see that's still very prevalent around the country. There's a lot of travel ball now, and that's not to knock travel ball, but that's a whole nother level. But on the very grassroots level, where kids just want to get out and have an opportunity, that volunteerism is prevalent throughout all throughout the United States. And it takes a village. There's some real truth to that, Jack. It takes a village. It can't be any one person. And seeing these snack shacks going full blast with parents rotating through and helping, to the umpires who are doing their best to help kids get through and understand their responsibility to the game and respect of the game, and the coaches who work closely and the parents who are supportive, it's alive and well. And we witnessed that in Oklahoma. We was, you know, all throughout Texas, Northern Arizona. You know, we were in Holbrook, Arizona, which is right by Winslow, Arizona. And sure enough, there was a great game going on, and the kids' parents were having a good time, and the coaches were really doing their job, and just a great example of everything we've seen for the last couple of years.
What have these youngsters taught you, Jeff Idelson?
They've taught me that the game is a game. Whether it's being played by adults or by little kids, it's still a game, and there's still a love of the game. And when you look into their eyes and just see how much they're enjoying being there, working with their teammates, loving putting the uniform on. You know, you talk to some kids who the night before opening day in Baxter Springs, they put the uniform on the night before. You know, they slept in it. That's something I did, you know, when I was a little kid. And it made me remember my youth. And in some ways, I think that's very, very good.
All right. You grew up in a little town in Massachusetts. You're a vendor for 6 years or so at Fenway Park. You go on to become the president of the Baseball Hall of Fame. And now you've got this tremendous grassroots baseball, you and June Fruth. Only in America, Jeff. Do you ever pinch yourself?
Every day, Jack. And, you know, during when I was here for so many years beforehand, we had a great internship program, and we bring in 20 kids a year. And I made it a point to have lunch with all of them once in groups of five, and just to learn about them and see what made them tick. You know, why were they in Cooperstown? What do they love about baseball? And I would say to them, look, I'm no different than you. I was an intern. I was an intern when I was 21 years old with the Boston Red Sox. I was a vendor at Fenway Park. And if you follow your passion, if you follow your dreams, you could be like me, and who's never once in 5.5 decades on this earth woken up and said, oh, no, I have to go to work. I've never said that. And I'm lucky. And my message to them was, chase the dream until someone tells you you can't, because you can always go back and do something you hate.
Jeff Idelson, most importantly, you're a Hall of Fame person. So thanks for all you do and the way in which you do it. Keep up the great, great work.
Thank you for your kind words, Jack. Pleasure to be with you tonight.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible.
Believe in yourself.